The place seemed to be overrun with women of all shapes, sizes, and ages. They appeared from the most unusual places, and did not hesitate one moment to ask passing servants what this cost, or what that was worth. They behaved, in short, like women the world over, parading around in very new clothes, with her hair done in what she regarded as the latest style, but which to me seemed terrible. But I was always biased when it came to women, and it was that on this day they seemed to get in the way. There was another set of women to complicate matters. The high-class woman in Tibet was expected to have huge stores of clothing and ample jewels. These she had to display, and as this would have entailed much changing and dressing, special girls, Chang girls, were employed to act as mannequins. They paraded around in mother's clothes, sat and drank innumerable cups of butter tea, and then went and changed into different clothing and jewelry. They mixed with the guests and became, to all intents and purposes, mother's assistant hostesses. Throughout the day these women would change their attire perhaps 5 or 6 times. The men were more interested in the entertainers in the gardens. A troop of acrobats had been brought in to add a touch of fun. 3 of them held up a pole about 15 feet high, and another acrobat climbed up and stood on his head on the top. Then the others snatched away the pole, leaving him to fall, turn, and land cat-like on his feet. The boys were watching, and immediately rushed away to a secluded spot to emulate the performance. 8 or 10 feet high, held it up, and the most daring climbed up and tried to stand on his head. Down he came, with an awful crump, straight on top of the others. Their heads were thick, and apart from egg-sized bruises, no harm was done. Mother appeared, leading the rest of the ladies to see the entertainments, and listen to the music. Atta was not difficult. The musicians were now well warmed up with copious amounts of Tibetan beer. For this occasion, Mother was particularly well dressed. She was wearing a yak wool skirt of deep russet red, reaching almost to the ankles. Her high boots of Tibetan felt were of the purest white, with blood red soles, and tastefully arranged red piping. Her bolero-type jacket was of a reddish-yellow, somewhat like father's monk robe. My later medical days, I should have described it as iodine on bandage. Beneath it she wore a blouse of purple silk as all harmonized, and had been chosen to represent the different classes of monks' garments. Across her right shoulder was a silk brocade sash which was caught at the left side of her waist by a massive gold circlet. From the shoulder to the waist not the sash was blood red, but from that point it shaded from pale lemon yellow to deep saffron when it reached the skirt hem. At her neck she had a gold cord which supported the 3 amulet bags which she always wore. It had been given to her on her marriage to father. One was from her family, one from father's family, and one, an unusual honor, was from the Dalai Lama. She wore much jewelry, because Tibetan women wear jewelry and ornaments in accordance with their station in life. A husband is expected to buy ornaments and jewelry whenever he has a rise in status. I had been busy for days past having her hair arranged in 108 plaits, each about as thick as a piece of whipcord. 108 is a Tibetan sacred number, and ladies with sufficient hair to make this number of plaits were considered to be most fortunate. Parted in the Madonna style, was supported on a wooden framework worn on top of the head like a hat, of red lacquered wood. It was studded with diamonds, jade, and gold discs. The hair trailed over it like rambler roses on a trellis. There had a string of coral shapes depending from her ear. The weight was so great that she had to use a red thread around the ear to support it, or risk having the lobe torn. The earring reached nearly to her waist. I watched in fascination to see how she could turn her head to the left or walking about, admiring the gardens, or sitting in groups discussing social affairs. The ladies, in particular, were busy with their talk. "My dear, Lady Doring is having a new floor laid and the ground bevels polished to a high gloss. Have you heard that young lama who was staying with Lady Rakasha, etc.?" But everyone was really waiting for the main item of the day. All this was a mere warming up for the events to come, when the priest astrologers would forecast my future and direct the path I should take through life. Upon them depended the career I should undertake. They grew old and the lengthening shadows crawled more quickly across the ground. The activities of the guests became slower, satiated with refreshments, and in a receptive mood. As the piles of food grew less, tired servants brought more, and that, too, went with the passage of time. The hired entertainers grew weary and one by one slipped away to the kitchens for a rest and more beer. Musicians were still in fine fettle, blowing their trumpets, clashing the cymbals, and thwacking the drums with gay abandon. With all the noise and uproar, the birds had been scared from their usual roosting places in the trees. And not only the birds were scared, the cats had dived precipitately into some safe refuge with the arrival of the first noisy guests. Even the huge black mastiffs which guarded the place were silent, their deep baying stilled in sleep. Fed and fed until they could eat no more. In the walled gardens, as the day grew yet darker, small boys flitted like gnomes between the cultivated trees, swinging lighted butter lamps and smoke incense censers, and at times leaping into the lower branches for a carefree frolic. Dotted about the grounds were golden incense braziers sending up their thick columns of fragrant smoke. Attending them were old women who also twirled clacking prayer wheels, each revolution of which sent thousands of prayers heavenwards in a state of perpetual fright. His walled gardens were famous throughout the country for their expensive imported plants and shrubs. To his way of thinking, the place was like a badly run zoo. Wandered around wringing his hands and uttering little moans of anguish when some guest stopped and fingered a bud. Particular danger were the apricot and pear trees, and the little dwarf apple trees. The larger and taller trees, poplar, willow, juniper, birch, and cypress, were festooned with streams of prayer flags, which fluttered gently in the soft evening breeze. The day died as the sun set behind the far distant peaks of the Himalayas. The lamaseries came the sound of trumpets signaling the passing of yet another day, and with it hundreds of butter lamps were set alight. They depended from the branches of trees, they swung from the projecting eaves of the houses, and others floated on the placid waters of the ornamental lake. Here they grounded, like boats on a sandbar, on the water lily leaves. There they drifted towards the floating swans seeking refuge near the island. The sound of a deep-toned gong, and everyone turned to watch the approaching procession. In the gardens a large marquee had been erected, with one completely open side. Inside was a raised dais on which were four of our Tibetan seats. But the procession approached the dais. Four servants carried upright poles, with large flares at the upper end. Four trumpeters with silver trumpets sounding a fanfare. Following them, mother and father reached the dais and stepped upon it. Then two old men, very old men, from the lamasery of the state oracle. These two old men from Nishung were the most experienced astrologers in the country. Their predictions have been proved correct time after time. Last week they had been called to predict for the Dalai Lama. Now they were going to do the same for a seven-year-old boy. Days they had been busy at their charts and computations. Long had been their discussions about trines, ecliptics, sesquiquadrates, and the opposing influence of this or that. I will discuss astrology in a later chapter. Two lamas carried the astrologer's notes and charts, two others stepped forward and helped the old seers to mount the steps of the dais. Side by side they stood, like two old ivory carvings. Their gorgeous robes of yellow Chinese brocade merely emphasized their age. Upon their heads they wore tall priest's hats, and their wrinkled necks seemed to wilt beneath the weight. People gathered around and sat on the ground on cushions brought by the servants. All gossip stopped, as people strained their ears to catch the shrill, piping voice of the astrologer-in-chief. Adre Micho Nanshig, he said, gods, devils, and men all behave in the same way, so the probable future can be foretold. And he droned for an hour and then stopped for a 10-minute rest. For yet another hour he went on outlining the future. Hala, extraordinary, exclaimed the entranced audience. So it was foretold, a boy of seven to enter a lamasery, after a hard feat of endurance, and there be trained as a priest surgeon. It hardships to leave the homeland, and go among strange people, to lose all and have to start again, and eventually to succeed. Gradually the crowd dispersed. Come from afar would stay the night at our house and depart in the morning. Travel with their retinues and with flares to light the way. Hooves, and the hoarse shouts of men, they assembled in the courtyard. Once again the ponderous gate swung open, and the company streamed through. Growing fainter in the distance was the clop-clop of the horses, and the chatter of their riders. until from without there was the silence of the night. Chapter 3 Last Days at Home. Inside the house there was still much activity. Tea was still being consumed in huge quantities, and food was disappearing as last-minute travelers fortified themselves against the coming night. All the rooms were occupied, and there was no room for me. Disconsolately I wandered around, idly kicking at stones and anything else in the way, but even that did not bring inspiration. Took any notice of me? The guests were tired and happy, the servants were tired and irritable. The horses have more feeling, I grumbled to myself. I will go and sleep with them. The stables were warm, and the fodder was soft, but for a time sleep would not come. Time I dozed a horse would nudge me, or a sudden burst of sound from the house would rouse me. The noises were stilled. I raised myself to one elbow and looked out. The lights were one by one flickering to blackness. Soon there was only the cold blue moonlight reflecting vividly from the snow-capped mountains. Horses slept, some on their feet and some on their sides. I too slept. Next morning I was awakened by a rough shake and a voice saying, "Come along, Dewsdale Obsang. I've got to get the horses ready and you are in the way." I got up and made my way into the house in search of food. There was much activity. We're preparing to leave, and mother was flitting from group to group for a last-minute chat, discussing improvements to the house and to the gardens. He was telling an old friend of his that he intended having glass imported from India so that our house would have glazed windows. None was made in the country, and the cost of bringing it from India was very high indeed. Windows have frames upon which is stretched paper, which is highly waxed and translucent, but not transparent. Those were heavy wooden shutters, not so much to keep burglars away as to prevent the ingress of grit carried by the strong winds. Grit, sometimes it was more like small pebbles, would tear through any unprotected windows. It would also deeply cut exposed hands and faces, and during the season of strong winds, such journeys were fraught with danger. The bull of Lhasa used to keep a wary eye upon the peak, and when it suddenly became hidden in a black haze everyone used to dash for shelter before the whipping, blood-bringing wind caught them. But not only humans were on the alert, animals also were on the watch, and it was no unusual sight to see horses and dogs leading the humans in the rush for shelter. Cats were never caught in a storm, and yaks were quite immune. Departure of the last of the guests, I was called before father, who said, "Go to the shopping center and buy your needs is required." I thought of the things I would need: a tsampa bowl made of wood, a cup, and a rosary. The cup would be in three parts: a stand, the cup, and its lid. This would be of silver. The rosary would be of wood, with its 108 beads highly polished. Date, the sacred number, also indicates the things which a monk has to remember. We set off, Tsu on his horse, and I on my pony. As we left the courtyard we turned right, later turning right again as we left the ring road past the Potala to enter the shopping center. I looked about me as if seeing the town for the first time, afraid that I was seeing it for the last time. Shops were crowded with chauffeuring merchants who had just arrived in Lhasa. Some were bringing tea from China, and others had brought cloth from India. Way through the crowd to the shops we wished to visit, every so often Tsu would call out a greeting to some old friend of former years. I had to get a robe of russet red. I was going to have it rather on a large size, not merely because I was growing, but for an equally practical reason. Voluminous robes, which are tied tightly at the waist, the upper portion is pulled up and forms a pouch which is the repository for all those items which the Tibetan male finds it necessary to carry. The average monk, for instance, will carry in this pouch his tsampa bowl, cup, a knife, various amulets, a rosary, a bag of roasted bagli and, not infrequently, a supply of tsampa. But remember, a monk carries upon his person all his worldly possessions. Athletic little purchases were rigidly supervised by Tsu, who permitted only the barest essentials, and those of merely mediocre quality as befitted a poor acolyte. They included sandals with yak leather soles, a small leather bag for roasted barley, a wooden tsampa bowl, wooden cup, not the silver affair I had hoped for, exclamation mark, and a carving knife. This, together with a very plain rosary which I had to polish myself, were to be my only possessions. Was a millionaire several times over, with huge estates all over the country, with jewels, and indeed much gold. But I, while I was draining, while further lived, I was to be just a very poor monk. Looked again at the street, at those two-storied buildings with the long, projecting eaves, at the shops with the shark's fins and the saddle covers displayed on the booths outside their doors. I listened once more to the cheerful banter of the traders and their customers haggling good-naturedly over the prices to be paid. The street had never looked more attractive, and I thought of the fortunate people who saw it every day and would continue to see it every day. Stray dogs ambled around, sniffing here and there, exchanging growls. Horses neighed softly to each other as they awaited the pleasure of their masters, groaned throatily as they meandered through the pedestrian throng. What mysteries lurked behind those paper-covered windows? But wonderful stores of goods, from all parts of the world, had passed through those sturdy wooden doors, and what tales those open shutters would tell if they could speak. All this I gazed upon as upon an old friend. It occurred to me that I would ever see these streets again. Even though but rarely, things I would have liked to have done, of the things I would have liked to buy. My reverie was shatteringly interrupted, and immense and menacing descended upon me, caught my ear and twisted it fiercely, while the voice of Tsu bellowed for all the world to hear, "Come on, Tuesday Lobsang, are you dead on your feet? I don't know what boys are coming to nowadays." And like this when I was a lad who did not seem to mind if I stayed behind without my ear, or retained it by following him. To come on way home, Tsu rode ahead, mumbling and moaning about the present generation, good-for-nothing lot, bone-idle labs living in a daze. Bright spot, as we turned into the Linker Road, there was a quite bitter wind whose great bulk ahead of me gave me a sheltered path. Could the things which I had bought, to my regret she agreed that they were good enough, cherishing the hope that she would overrule Tsu and say that I could have better quality articles. So once again my hopes of having a silver cup were shattered, and I had to make do with the wooden one turned on a hand lathe in the bazaars of Lhasa. To be left alone for my last week, they dragged me round to the other big houses in Lhasa so that I could pay my respects. Not that I was feeling respectful. They revelled in the journeyings, in the interchange of a social conversation, and in the polite tittle-tattle which made up the everyday round. Diff. To me all this was a genuine ordeal, as I was definitely not born with the attributes which make one suffer fools gladly. I wanted to be out in the open enjoying myself for the few days remaining, out flying my kites, jumping with my pole, and practicing archery, instead of which I had to be dragged around like a prize yak, being shown off to frumpish old women who had nothing to do all day but to sit on silk cushions and call for a servant in order to gratify their slightest whim. But it was not only mother who caused me so much heartburning. Visit the Drebung Lamasery, and I was taken along to see the place. Drebung is the largest lamasery in the world, with its 10,000 monks, its high temples, little stone houses, and terraced buildings rising tier upon tier. Community was like a walled town, and like a good town, it was self-supporting. Bung means rice heap, and from a distance it did look like a heap of rice, with the towers and domes gleaming in the light. Just at this time I was not in a mood to appreciate architectural beauties. I was feeling distinctly glum at having to waste precious time like this, busy with the abbot and his assistants, and I, like a waif of the storm, wandered disconsolately around. It made me shiver with fright when I saw how some of the small novices were treated. The rice heap was really 7 lamasaries in one, 7 distinct orders, 7 separate colleges formed its composition. It was so large that no one man was in charge. 14 abbots ruled here, and stern disciplinarians they were. I was glad when this pleasant jaunt across a sunlit plain, to quote father, came to an end, but more glad to know that I was not going to be consigned to Drebung, or to Sura, 3 miles north of Lhasa. The week drew to an end. My kites were taken from me and given away, my bows and beautifully feathered arrows were broken to signify that I was no longer a child and had no use for such things. Felt that my heart, too, was being broken, but no one seemed to think that important. At nightfall father sent for me, and I went to his room, with its wonderful decorations, and the old and valuable books lining the walls. He sat by the side of the main altar, which was in his room, and bade me kneel before him. This was to be the ceremony of the opening of the book. In this large volume, some 3 feet wide by 12 inches long, were recorded all the details of our family for centuries past. Gave the names of the first of our line, and gave details of the deeds which caused them to be raised to the nobility. The services we had done for our country and for our ruler, Upon the old, yellowed pages I read history second time. The book was open for me. First it had been to record my conception and birth. Here were the details upon which the astrologers based their forecasts for the actual charts prepared at the time. Now I had to sign the book myself, for tomorrow a new life for me would start when I entered the Lamasery. The heavy carved wooden covers were slowly replaced. The golden clasps pressing the thick, handmade sheets of juniper paper were clipped on. Was heavy. Even father staggered a little beneath its weight as he rose to replace it in the golden casket which was its protection. Reverently he turned to lower the casket into the deep stone recess beneath the altar. All silver brazier he heated wax, poured it upon the stone lid of the recess, and impressed his seal, so that the book would not be disturbed. Settled himself comfortably on his cushions, a touch of a gong at his elbow, and a servant brought him buttered tea. There was a long silence, and then he told me of the secret history of Tibet, history going back thousands and thousands of years, a story which was old before the flood and washed by an ancient sea, and of how excavations had proved it. Again near Lhasa could bring to light fossilized sea animals and strange shells. There were artifacts, too, of strange metal and unknown purpose. Who visited certain caves in the district would discover them and bring them to father. He showed me some. Then his mood changed. Because of the law, to the high-born shall be shown austerity, while to the low shall be shown compassion, he said. You will undergo a severe ordeal before you are permitted to enter the Lamasery. He enjoined upon me the utter necessity of implicit obedience to all commands which would be given to me. His concluding remarks were not conducive to a good night's sleep. He said, "My son, you think I am hard and uncaring, but I care only for the name of the family. To you, if you fail in this test for entry, do not return here a stranger to this household." At, with no further word, he motioned me to leave him. Earlier in the evening I had said my farewells to my sister Yasuo. She had been upset, for we had played together so often and she was now but 9 years of age, while I would be 7, tomorrow was not to be found. She had gone to bed and I was not able to say goodbye to her. My lonely way to my own room for the last time and arrange the cushions which formed my bed. I lay down, but not to sleep. For a very long time I lay there thinking of the things my father had told me that night, thinking of the strong dislike father had for children, and thinking of the dreaded morrow when for the first time I would sleep away from home. The moon moved across the sky. A night bird fluttered on the windowsill. Above came the flap flap of prayer flags slapping against bare wooden poles. I fell asleep, but as the first feeble rays of the sun replaced the light of the moon, I was awakened by a servant and given a bowl of tsampa and a cup of buttered tea. As I was eating this meager fare, Tsu bustled into the room. "Boy," he said, "our ways part. Thank goodness for that. Now I can go back to my horses. But acquit yourself well. Remember all that I have taught you." With that he turned upon his heel and left the room. Not appreciated at the time, this was the kindest method. Emotional farewells would have made it very much more difficult for me to leave home, for the first time, forever, as I thought. If mother had been up to see me off then no doubt I should have tried to persuade her to allow me to remain at home. Many Tibetan children have quite soft lives. Mine was hard by any standard, and the lack of farewells, as I later found, was on father's order, so that I should learn discipline and firmness early in life. Finished my breakfast, tucked my tsampa bowl and cup into the front of my robe, and rolled a spare robe and a pair of felt boots into a bundle. Across the room a servant bade me go softly and not waken the sleeping household. The corridor went. False dawn had been replaced by the darkness that comes before the true dawn as I made my way down the steps and onto the road. Lonely, frightened, and sick at heart. Chapter 4. At the temple gates, the road led straight ahead to Chakpor Lamasery, the temple of Tibetan medicine. As the day grew lighter and at the gate leading to the entrance compound I met two others, who also desired admission. We looked each other over, and I think that none of us was much impressed by what we saw in the others. We decided that we would have to be sociable if we were going to endure the same training. Sometime we knocked timidly, and nothing happened. Stooped and picked up a large stone and really did make enough noise to attract attention. A monk appeared, waving a stick which to our frightened eyes looked as large as a young tree. "Do you young devils want?" he exclaimed. Do you think that I have nothing better to do than answer the door to such as you? We want to be monks, I replied. You look more like monkeys to me, he said. Wait there and do not move. The master of the acolytes will see you when he is ready. And shut, nearly knocking one of the other boys flat on his back, he having moved incautiously near. Upon the ground, our legs were tired with standing. People came to the lamasery, and went. The pleasant smell of food was wafted to us through a small windows, tantalizing us with the thought of satisfying our growing hunger. Food, so near, yet so utterly unattainable. The door was flung open with violence, and a tall, skinny man appeared in the opening. And what do you miserable scamps want? We said. Goodness me, he exclaimed. What garbage is coming to the lamasery nowadays? He beckoned us to enter the vast walled enclosure which was the perimeter of the lamasery grounds. We were, who we were, even why we were, gathered, without difficulty, that he was not at all impressed with us. To one, the son of a herdsman, he said, enter quickly. If you can pass your tests you can stay. You, boy, did you say, son of a butcher? A cutter up of flesh? A transgressor of the laws of Buddha? And you come here? Be off with you, quickly, or I will have you flogged round the road. Poor wretched boy forgot his tiredness in a sudden burst of speed as the monk lunged at him. Wheeling in a flash he leapt forward, leaving little scuffs of disturbed dust as his feet touched the ground in his hurry. I was left, alone on my seventh birthday. The gaunt monk turned his fierce gaze in my direction, almost causing me to shrivel on the spot with fright. His stick menacingly. And you? What have we here? Oh, a young prince who wants to turn religious. Must see what you are made of first, my fine fellow. See what kind of stuffing you have. This is not the place for soft and pampered princelings. Take 40 paces backwards and sit in the attitude of contemplation until I tell you otherwise, and do not move an eyelash. Abruptly and went away. Sadly I picked up my pathetic little bundle, and took the 40 steps back. On my knees I went, then sat cross-legged as commanded. So I sat throughout the day. Unmoving. Dust blew against me, forming little mounds in the clips of my upturned hands, piling on my shoulders and lodging in my hair. And to fade my hunger increased, and my throat was racked with the harshness of thirst, for I had had no food or drink since the first fight of dawn. Passing monks, and there were many, took no heed. Wandering dogs paused a while to sniff curiously, then they too went away. A gang of small boys came past. One idly flipped a stone in my direction. It struck the side of my head and caused the blood to flow. I did not stir. I was afraid to. If I failed my endurance test, my father would not allow me to enter what had been my home. Nowhere for me to go. Nothing that I could do. Only remain motionless, aching in every muscle, stiff in every joint. The sun hid behind the mountains and the sky became dark. Stars shone bright against the blackness of the sky. From the lamasery windows thousands of little butter lamps flickered into flame. A chill wind, the leaves of the willows hissed and rattled, and about me there were all the faint sounds which go to make the strange noises of the night. And motionless for the strongest of reasons, I was too frightened to move and I was very stiff. Presently came the soft swoosh swoosh of approaching monks' sandals slithering over the gritty way, the steps of an old man feeling his way in the darkness. A form loomed up before me, the form of an old monk bent and gnarled with the passage of austere years. Hands shook with age, a matter of some concern to me when I saw that he was spilling the tea he was carrying in one hand. He held a small bowl of tsampa. He passed them to me. At first I made no move to take them. Divining my thoughts, he said, take them, my son, for you can move during the hours of darkness. So I drank the tea and transferred the tsampa to my own bowl. The old monk said, now sleep, but at the first rays of the sun take your stance here in the same position, for this is a test, and is not the wanton cruelty which you may now consider it to be. Only those who pass this test can aspire to the higher ranks of our order. He gathered up the cup and the bowl and went away, and stretched my legs, then lay upon my side and finished the tsampa. Tired, so scooping a depression in the ground to accommodate my hip bone, and placing my spare robe beneath my head, I lay down. But in easy years, at all times father had been strict, frightfully strict, but even so this was my first night away from home and the whole day had been spent in one position, hungry, thirsty, and motionless fear of what the morrow would bring, or what more would be demanded of me. Now I had to sleep alone beneath the frosty sky, alone with my terror of the darkness, alone with my terrors of the days to come. It seemed that I had hardly closed my eyes before the sound of a trumpet awakened me.